From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, new governor, new attorney general, looking at Enbridge Line 5 through a legal lens.
Enbridge is the state of Michigan's tenant. And as the attorney general said, this tenant has not been complying with the terms of its lease.
Plus, the latest on keeping Asian carp out of the Great Lakes.
If we look at what could really do damage to the Great Lakes ecosystem, economy, and our way of life, Asian carp is right at the very top of that list.
U of M hires a gymnastics coach who left USA Gymnastics in the fallout over Larry Nassar. Within 3 days, she's fired after an outcry by regents and Nassar survivors.
Rachel Den Hollander, you've had her on your show. She is not hard to reach. Maybe Michigan should have reached out to her first.
And recognizing women with ADHD. Those stories and more for you today on Stateside. Hello, welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Gretchen Whitmer ran for governor and won while promising to decommission Enbridge's Line 5. Dana Nessel ran for state attorney general and won, also promising to shut down the twin oil pipelines. And on her first full day in office, Governor Whitmer asked AG Nessel to conduct a legal review of Public Act 359. That's the law fast-tracked through the lame duck legislature. It clears the way for the aging Line 5 to be replaced by a new pipeline encased in a tunnel beneath the Straits of Mackinac. So what might be the legal issues involved in trying to shut down Line 5 and stop the tunnel deal? For that, we turn to Wayne State University law professor Noah Hall. He specializes in environmental and water law. Noah, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
Now, first, we need to make it clear. You have not spoken with AG Dana Nessel about this, correct?
Absolutely. I've had no communication with Attorney General Nessel on this matter.
So we're going to talk about, based on what you know of environmental law and what she and Governor Whitmer have said. So we're going to talk about this 65-year-old Line 5 pipeline and the idea of replacing them with the new lines encased in a tunnel. Michigan Radio's Doug Tribou asked Attorney General Nessel during a candidate interview last fall about what her legal strategy might be, and here is what she said.
That's a violation of easement. The easement is between Enbridge and the state of Michigan. And as the attorney for the state of Michigan, it's your job to enforce that contract. I would bring a case in the Court of Claims and ask for an immediate injunction that Line 5 be shut down.
What are your thoughts on that strategy?
I think the state of Michigan has a good attorney on the job. First of all, in full disclosure, I've been involved in litigation against Enbridge over the years. So there you go.
There you are. Yeah.
But taking a look at the Attorney General's potential case against Enbridge, she has some very powerful tools at her disposal that I think will set her up for success in court. First of all, and most fundamentally, Enbridge is operating its Line 5 pipeline on the state of Michigan's property via a lease. Enbridge is the state of Michigan's tenant. And as the Attorney General said, this tenant has not been complying with the terms of its lease. And any landlord faced with a situation where your tenant is violating the terms of the lease absolutely has the legal authority to go to court and either enforce the terms of the lease or evict the tenant. So that's the first step. And then Attorney General Nessel, on behalf of the state of Michigan, has some broader, more powerful legal tools at her disposal. Enbridge's operation of the pipeline is essentially an ongoing public nuisance. Ever since 2010, when Enbridge's parallel pipeline ruptured and caused the largest inland oil spill in U.S. history, destroying the Kalamazoo River, Enbridge's operation of pipelines has been increasingly demonstrated to be negligent. They've failed to perform maintenance and upkeep. They've failed to do inspections. They've allowed disrepairs to reach really critical points where the pipeline could rupture and fail any day now. It's a disaster waiting to happen, a classic public nuisance. And the Attorney General has the legal authority, if not the mandate, to go to court and shut it down, obviously because a rupture or a break in the pipeline in the Straits of Mackinac would be even more disastrous than it was for the Kalamazoo River.
So that's the one issue. What about the tunnel deal?
Sure. The tunnel deal is crooked every which way, and fortunately, we have some well-established Supreme Court law that could prevent this deal from going forward. A little bit of a history lesson. In the late 1800s, the state of Illinois' legislature, in a move that maybe kind of looks like Michigan in 2018, tried leasing off a chunk of Chicago's shoreline of Lake Michigan to a railroad company. It was basically a political deal to a wealthy business in the state. And the next year, the legislature actually rescinded the deal. The railroad company sued the state of Illinois, much as Enbridge has threatened to sue the state of Michigan. And the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that not only could the state of Illinois rescind the deal, in fact, the state of Illinois couldn't grant the railroad the Great Lakes bottom lands in the first place. The Great Lakes and the lands beneath the Great Lakes are what's called public trust. This means that they don't belong to the state of Michigan like state property. The Great Lakes bottom lands aren't a building of the state of Michigan that the governor can lease at his will. The Great Lakes bottom lands are a public trust, and the state of Michigan can only do things with the Great Lakes bottom lands that are consistent with that public trust. That means two things. It means, first of all, that any decision by the state of Michigan involving the Great Lakes and its bottom lands has to be made on the up and up. The court is going to review the circumstances and the politics of any fundamental decision affecting the Great Lakes, just as it did in this historic Illinois Central case. And for the legislature to create a new authority that's not accountable to the public in a lame duck session, empower that authority to make decisions about the Great Lakes, and essentially strip the public from any meaningful participation or democratic accountability is exactly the type of disregard for public trust that the Supreme Court shot down over 100 years ago. Secondly, the public trust doctrine requires that any use of the Great Lakes ultimately not just benefit the public, but ensure that the Great Lakes will be there for future generations. This deal does not do that. This deal puts the Great Lakes at tremendous risk for future generations and goes completely against really the fundamental nature of stewarding the Great Lakes as an ongoing resource, not as a kind of a one-time drawdown.
So focusing on shutting down Line 5, if that becomes the focus, what does that set up in trying to make that happen? Is that missing the point?
So Attorney General Nessel has a little bit of a whack-a-mole problem in front of her. She wants to shut down the existing Line 5 and shut down this possibility of the new tunnel being built as an alternative to the existing Line 5. I hope she goes after both aggressively and simultaneously. We don't want to kill the tunnel deal as a violation of the public trust, but then see Line 5 continue to operate as is. And similarly, we don't want to shut down Line 5 only to build a new tunnel and create a new problem for the next 50 years. We want to solve this problem once and for all, and that means shutting down Line 5, not building a new tunnel, finding a new way to meet our energy needs.
You know, as all this conversation happens about Line 5, the question remains, if you go through all of that up there under the Straits, what about the lines right. that are running along the bottom of the St. Clair River? We never hear about the one going to Sarnia. Doesn't that present an equal danger?
The state of Michigan, sitting in the heart of the Great Lakes, is unfortunately in the crosshairs of numerous pipelines that connect oil from where it's drilled to where it's refined to where it's sold. And a lot of this does come through Michigan. That said, I wouldn't say that all pipelines are created equal and all risks of pipelines are equal. Some pipelines are a lot bigger, older, less structurally sound than others. Some pipelines are in more vulnerable areas than others. Some pipelines essentially couldn't be fixed in the case of a spill. Michigan needs to think strategically, long-term, and protectively about the Great Lakes for how we're going to allow petroleum to move through our state. And shutting down a pipeline just to move the oil through trucks or rail isn't really going to be much of a solution either. The state of Michigan needs a long-term plan for how it's going to move energy through the state, what its energy needs are.
Because it leaves me wondering when you talk about we need to rethink the way we meet our energy needs. So as you think about
I'm just going to say what I want to say.
Honestly, what you want to say. Yeah, what would that look like?
The truth is that the oil pipelines moving through the Great Lakes are outdated and part of an energy infrastructure from the 19th, if not 20th century. We're entering the 21st century. The state of Michigan needs to be investing in clean energy and not doubling down on ways of moving oil through water, which have been one failure after another. And while the state of Michigan is contemplating building a new oil pipeline, other states and other regions are investing in clean alternative energy that's going to be powering their economy for the 21st century. Michiganders deserve the exact same.
But as that evolves, what of the households and businesses in the Upper Peninsula that rely on the propane that comes through Line 5?
Well, an independent study showed that the need to serve propane in the UP can be met in other ways, and Line 5 is not a big part of that solution. Ultimately, the propane needs for the UP can be met with much safer, cheaper, less riskier alternatives. And I haven't talked to anybody in the UP who thinks running oil pipelines through the Straits of Mackinac is a good idea or a good way to get them propane.
What will you be watching for from Governor Whitmer and Attorney General Nessel?
For them to continue with the work that they've promised and pledged as candidates, I expect Attorney General Nessel to take a very hard line against the current Line 5 and the proposal to build this tunnel. I hope Governor Whitmer will be supportive as well. And then long term, I'm very optimistic that Governor Whitmer and her staff are going to create a new clean energy agenda for Michigan. So instead of debating pipelines and coal plants and where we're going to store dirty fuels and all of the toxic effects of burning oil, refining oil, storing pet coke on the banks of the Detroit River, it's time to move beyond all of this. And it's time to start investing in clean energy, getting people to work on clean energy, building clean energy infrastructure, and making clean energy a part of why Michigan is competitive and a wonderful place to live.
Wayne State University law professor, environmental law professor Noah Hall, thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
And we want to note, Enbridge Energy is a corporate sponsor of Michigan Radio. Still to come on Stateside, as the Army Corps of Engineers takes public comment on a draft plan to keep Asian carp out of the Great Lakes, we discuss what would happen should that plan fail.
I'll tell you, I spend a lot of time working with scientists, and they're not ones that are prone to hyperbole. The issue of Asian carp gets scientists as close to a panic as I've ever seen.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This week marks the 210th birthday of one of America's best-known writers, Edgar Allan Poe, born on January 19, 1809. He was the epitome of the tortured poet, the master of the creepy and macabre. Here's the climax of one of his best-known stories, The Tell-Tale Heart, as read by G.M. Danielson.
But anything was better than this agony. Anything was more tolerable than this derision. I could bear those hypocritical smiles no longer. I felt I must scream or die. And now again, hark. Louder, 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 louder. Villains! I shrieked. Dissemble no more. I admit the deed. Tear up the planks. Here, here. It is the beating of his hideous heart.
And indeed, Edgar Allan Poe's heart stopped beating at a very young age. He was only 40 when he died under a cloud of mystery. University of Michigan medical historian and PBS contributor Dr. Howard Markell is here to do some medical detective work. Even Poe's burial place is kind of shrouded in mystery. Didn't he used to have someone leaving offerings each year?
Yes. There was the Poe toaster, he was called. And it began either in the late 30s or the 40s. And it was a man dressed in black with a wide brim hat and a white scarf. And he had a silver tip cane. And he would toast to Poe's memory with Martell cognac, leave the bottle of cognac on the gravesite, as well as a single red rose. There's been even mysteries of who that Poe toaster was and when he passed away, who took it over and things like that. But yes, people reported on that every year in the Baltimore Press.
And as I recall, literary critic H.L. Mencken had his own rather inimitable way of honoring Poe.
Yes, Mencken lived only a few blocks away. And when he had one of his famous drinking parties, he would take the walk over to the west side of Baltimore where Poe is buried in and urinate on his grave as, quote, a sign of respect.
All right. So take us back to the circumstances of Poe's death in 1849.
Well, it's October 3rd, mm-hmm. and it's election night, and he was found literally in the gutter, inebriated, out of his gourd, so to speak, bedraggled, probably beaten, and in another man's clothing. And the man who found him was a pressman for the Baltimore Sun, and he brought him to the nearest hospital. And there he stayed for the next 4 or 5 days, completely incoherent. He would utter out Reynolds, but nobody knows who Reynolds was. And then he died on a Sunday morning in February of 1849.
And what was the official cause of death?
Well, the doctor called it phrenitis, which is an early 19th century term for brain congestion or brain swelling. It was often a term for alcoholism and its toxic effects.
And a polite way of saying
a polite way,
someone
yes,
drank right. himself to death
exactly,
in essence.
Exactly.
But what was particularly mysterious about the location of where he was?
Well, that's what's so neat. He was right outside Gunner's Hall in West Baltimore, which no longer exists. And that was a polling place. And there was this fascinating habit or tradition, something called cooping. And I love this when you think about fraud at the polls today. We have nothing on the early 19th century America. And gangs who represented different parties, Democrats, Republicans, or what have you, would kidnap people. They would then beat the living daylights out of them and make them vote under different personalities or names at the nearest polling station. Then they would pull them out, feed them to a drink or a beer or a whiskey, redress them in another man's clothing, and then they would show up as a different person. And this went on and on and on until they were no longer coherent. And that makes a lot of sense when you think of Poe, beaten up, bedraggled, wearing another man's clothing and right outside of a polling place.
But there were other theories. Doctors,
yes.
You write how doctors really enjoy kind of spinning ideas as far as what might have happened.
Yeah, we all sit together and smoke cigars and drink cognac and talk about he went that away. And particularly with these older cases, but there's no medical records or a death certificate for Poe, and we don't have a lot of material to work on. So you're never really wrong. But one person suggests that he died of carbon monoxide poisoning, which is not a terrible theory when you think of people who stayed indoors a lot and used either coal gas or coal-burning stoves to heat themselves. It is possible they could have inhaled too much carbon monoxide. They actually exhumed the body and took nail clippings, but it was inconclusive. Another doctor suggested he died of mercury poisoning. Now, in the summer of 1849 was a terrible cholera epidemic. It reached as far as Michigan, in fact, as far west as St. Louis. And mercury was a medicine that was given, all for naught, but was given quite commonly. But while Poe did have mercury in his toenails, it was way too low of a dose to cause mercury poisoning. Those were two of the best theories, but people have suggested brain tumors, influenza, rabies, you name it, they've said it.
And he wasn't from Baltimore.
No, he was really from Richmond, Virginia, and he also had a home in New York. He was making his way from Richmond to Philadelphia, where he was supposed to work on a gig, so to speak, editing a now-forgotten woman's poetry, and he never made it there. He probably stopped off in Baltimore on election night to drink with his buddies from West Point, which he was kicked out of, by the way, for insubordination. So he was the tortured poet, perhaps for his entire life.
It is fascinating when you think of the nature of his writing, the fact that this ending, and it was even, but you write that school children pooled money to buy him a grave.
Yes. He was initially buried in an unmarked grave in Westminster Burial Ground in Baltimore. And then in 1875, he was exhumed and a beautiful monument was put up, paid for by the pennies of Baltimore school children. When a penny went far, further than it does today. And I used to pass by – when I lived in Baltimore, I used to pass by that monument every time I went to the airport, and I always tipped my hat to Edgar Allan Poe.
The 210th birthday this week of one of America's best-known tortured writers, U of N medical historian and PBS contributor, Dr. Howard Markel. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Ask anyone who cares about the Great Lakes, what worries you? And there's little doubt that list of worries would include Asian carp. These invasive and harmful fish pose an enormous threat to our Great Lakes, our fisheries, and tourism. This Michigan radio listener speaks for many with her question.
Hi, my name is Barb Zabel. I live in Southeast Michigan, and one of the issues we are dealing with for a long time is the Asian carp issue and the threat to the Great Lakes. Have we kept them out of the Great Lakes? How have they contained them? And what are we doing to keep them out of the Great Lakes presently?
Well, let's see if we can get some answers to those questions as we welcome Mike Schreiberg, who's the Great Lakes Regional Director for the National Wildlife Federation. How often do you get questions like Barb's?
Well, very often. When I give talks, this is usually the number one question that people ask about the Great Lakes, maybe after Line 5 if you're in Michigan.
Okay, so between Line 5 and Asian carp, those are the big two worries.
Those are the top things on people's minds in my opinion.
All right. So her first question, have we been able to keep them out of the Great Lakes?
Well, the answer is yes and no. The leading edge of Asian carp is about 50 miles from the Great Lakes right now and working its way towards the lakes. We have found two Asian carp that are in the Great Lakes ecosystem, meaning they have access to the lakes. They're beyond the barriers designed to keep them out, but they weren't quite in Lake Michigan yet. They were about 5 miles away.
And they're coming up from the Mississippi River.
That's correct.
All right.
They were accidentally released there, and they've been making their way up for decades.
For decades. And we have been talking about this for years and years. And I'm wondering, on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being no worries, everything's good, to 10 being worry on an apocalyptic scale, where would you rank your degree of concern about Asian carp?
Oh, it's like a 9. I mean, this is if we look at what could really do damage to the Great Lakes ecosystem, economy, and our way of life, Asian carp is right at the very top of that list.
And do we know exactly how to keep Asian carp from getting into the Great Lakes from the Mississippi River?
Well, right now there are 3 electric barriers that have some chance of keeping them out, but they go down from time to time. When boats come through, they have to take them down temporarily, and that is a solution that nobody thinks is a permanent one. What's on the table right now is a solution that would be more permanent, farther downstream in an area called Brandon Road Lock and Dam. And that would give us a much higher probability, not 100%, but a much higher probability of keeping Asian carp out of the Great Lakes.
And this is something that the Army Corps of Engineers studied and came up with this plan, the Brandon Road Plan?
Yes, in a painfully slow process that happens with the Army Corps. But they finally have a draft plan available. And there's a public comment period going on right now through the end of February. So it is moving, glacial pace, but it's starting to pick up steam. And this is the critical year for Congress to act on this.
All right. And we'll talk about congressional action in just a moment. But we also should say, you say a glacial pace, we should remind everyone, and we talked about it on Stateside, that draft plan did not come out until there was a 6-month delay. Why was that?
I wish I could give you the answer to that. I mean, it's been 10 years of study so far. The Trump administration has not been friendly to this plan, and we think some of the delays have been happening on that end. Early in the Trump administration, there was a delay that was directly due to that. But it's been a slow process and pretty obtuse process as well.
I'm also hearing a price tag for the Brandon Road Plan of around $778 million. Does that kind of jibe with what you're hearing?
Yes, that is it. That includes a large portion of what they call contingency, money that you hope will not be spent, about $300 million of that at least. But it's the price tag right now is $780 million.
And what would that buy us? What would we get with this Brandon Road plan that's better than these electric barriers that are up now?
The best way to describe is it requires Asian carp to run the gauntlet before they can reach the Great Lakes. So they're already swimming upstream, but this puts not only electrical barriers, noise barriers, bubbles, which actually repel the fish, and then really close inspection because barges are going to go around this to make sure that they don't get stuck in the small spaces in between barges or around them. They wash them with water jets. It's a very, very complex and highly regarded system that should have very high efficacy in keeping Asian carp out of the Great Lakes.
If you just joined us, we're talking with Mike Schreiberg, who is the Great Lakes Regional Director for the National Wildlife Federation, on the latest in the effort to keep Asian carp from moving from the Mississippi River into the Great Lakes, particularly Lake Michigan. And so here we are at the start of a new year. We have some new governors, notably here in Michigan and in Illinois. Fun fact, we might have all missed this while we were occupied with the holidays at the end of last year. The former governor of Illinois rejected an $8 million offer of aid from former Governor Rick Snyder. It was aid to induce Illinois to support this Brandon Road project. Why did he reject that aid?
Well, what he said is we don't need that money yet because it's to operate this barrier and it's not in place yet. But there was a lot of politics going on. The governor of Illinois, Bruce Rauner, was largely opposed to this Brandon Road lock and dam. He was concerned about the shipping interest in his state. Governor Pritzker, the new governor of Illinois, has come in with a much higher degree of concern about the environment in Great Lakes. As I understand it, has already been in good talks with our new governor in Michigan, Whitmer. So I think times are changing.
Both of them being Democrats. And Governor Whitmer actually went to the White House. And my understanding is she talked about Asian carp with President Trump.
Yes, Governor Whitmer and Governor Pritzker. Their response was that the president had no idea what Asian carp was or what they did, but that he was anxious to work with them and to look into it. It was a little surprising. I say that only tongue-in-cheek. I can only say what they reported, but I would love to be a fly on the wall for that conversation.
So tell us exactly where things are with this Brandon Road plan.
Yeah, so the draft proposal is out. That will close in February. Then there'll be a final report to Congress. But the most important thing is a decision will be made in next year's budget appropriations, most likely in Congress, about whether to fund this plan or not. And that's really going to be the critical point because there has to be congressional funding. Federal appropriations are something like 60 to 70% of it, and then states come in on top of that. That's where the money offered from Michigan is related to that, at least.
We have to talk politics. Here we are, as you and I talk, we are in a point in our history where we can't get Congress to act in unison to prevent this partial government shutdown. Politically, where do you think this is going to fall?
Well, I'll tell you, I have hope on this because there is strong support across the region. Right? Our government has been completely dysfunctional, yet we're still doing things from Congress like funding the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative each year. It's one of the few bipartisan things coming up.
After it was zeroed out in the Trump budget.
That's right. The Trump budget zeroed it out, but congressional members led by Republicans actually brought it back into the budget. So the Great Lakes, as an issue, and because it's so deeply tied with our culture in the region, have been able to transcend politics. I'm hoping that's what continues to happen, and that's what gives me high hope for this.
What are you hearing from the scientific community? Let's take politics out of it. And I know you talk with water researchers. We've talked with them here on Stateside, the scientists who are really trying to apply their knowledge to this problem. Do they feel like we can still make a difference? Or do you hear from scientists that maybe we've just spent too long talking and that this could be a done deal?
I'll tell you, I spend a lot of time working with scientists, and they're not ones that are prone to hyperbole.
Right.
The issue of Asian carp gets scientists as close to a panic as I've ever seen. A study that came out from the University of Michigan, for example, showed that if Asian carp got into Lake Erie, where they would be most likely to proliferate, they like warmer, shallower water, they could be 30% of all the biomass in the lake. That means if you weighed every living creature in the lake, 30% could be Asian carp if they get in. That is an ecosystem devastation on a scale that we haven't seen in the Great Lakes in a long time, maybe akin to what we've seen with the zebra and quagga mussels. So scientists are, I don't know how else to describe it other than panicked. And it's not normal for the normally very unflappable scientists that we work with.
And what's their outlook for all of the Great Lakes?
Well, less so. So like, for example, Lake Superior, it'd be hard to see Asian carp getting established there. But in Lake Michigan, what you'd find is in some of the shallower areas, some of the tributaries, and they could move up and down the coast. But one thing is the Asian carp have proved really, really resilient. So we don't really know what the impacts would be. At every stage where we thought maybe the population would go down, maybe they'd be stopped, they've proved amazingly adaptable. So it concerns me and it concerns the scientists that I interact with on a daily basis very, very much.
And I guess it does beg the question. Then you say they're adaptable, they're resilient, they're canny. So let's just say $778 million later, this Brandon Road plan is in place and they still get through.
we'd have a major problem. I mean, you do your best to fish them out. That's what they're doing right now to try and keep them from advancing the Brandon Road. Because think about it, even in the best case, this doesn't get built for another 8 or 9 years. What they're doing right now is they're fishing them out and trying to make sure that that leading front of them, think about where they're reproducing, is going back downstream. And that requires a huge amount of effort to do that. You could see that on the Great Lakes. There are contingency plans in place. The Fish and Wildlife Service has been very proactive on if there were to be an Asian carp, you'd immediately fish out that area to make sure that they can establish a breeding population. But it's a contingency that we have to be prepared for, but we very much hope never to have to implement.
How can people who care about this comment on this plan?
Well, they can comment directly. This is something that's open to any citizens to comment on. I actually think, though, the more impactful thing is contacting their governors. You know, in Michigan, obviously, Governor Whitmer is engaged on this, and their congresspeople, because that's going to be the most critical point. The comments right now are more on the technical side. The political side is really where citizens can weigh in. And if our congresspeople hear this as a priority, that's going to go a long way, because there's some critical budget decisions coming up.
Mike Schreiber, Great Lakes Regional Director for the National Wildlife Federation. Thank you so much, Mike.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, the University of Michigan Athletic Department quickly reversed its decision to hire a former USA Gymnastics official as a consultant after heavy criticism from NASCAR survivors.
Whatever her role was in the USA gymnastics program, she will not have a role at Michigan, and that strikes me as appropriate.
We will talk with Michigan Radio Sports commentator John Eubacon about what other schools should learn from U of M's hiring misstep. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On Thursday, the University of Michigan hired a new gymnastics consultant. On Saturday, they announced the hiring. On Sunday, the school fired her. That consultant was Rhonda Fain, a former senior vice president of USA Gymnastics. She left USAG amidst the fallout from the Larry Nassar scandal. Here with us is U of M sports commentator John Eubacon. And John, attorney John Manley, who has been on Stateside, has represented a number of Nassar survivors, tweeted this out yesterday, and I'm quoting here, "Fain knew that Larry Nassar molested Maggie Nichols, Allie Raisman, and Michaela Maroney in June 15. She did not report to law enforcement as required by law. She alerted no one outside USAG and did not tell MSU," unquote. So, John, why would the University of Michigan hire her in the first place?
That is a very hard one to answer, my friend. I love Bev Plotkin. She's the head coach of the women's program. She's highly successful. Her athletes have done extraordinarily well, both in school, in gymnastics, and I should say afterwards as well, doctors and lawyers and you name it out of that group. But this one's a head-scratcher. Now, a counter-argument has been made by some on Twitter that she did report within a week to her superiors as required. The FBI was on it. So there is some exonerating evidence. However, that's really for the court of law. The better question is, does that rise to the level of wanting to hire her for the University of Michigan to basically touch herself with a scandal that has not touched Michigan at all and has cost Michigan State $500 million.
And NASCAR survivor Morgan McCall, who is a student at U of M, someone else who has spoken with us on Stateside, she says the Fain hire sent a message that athletic success, reputation take precedent over student safety. And she also tweeted, and I'm quoting her here, "For those asking why Rhonda Fain doesn't deserve a second chance to work with athletes, there is no second chance for the hundreds of children that were molested after Rhonda Fain was personally alerted of NASCAR's misconduct in 2015. What would you add to that?
Not a thing. I think that Morgan has spoken very clearly and powerfully about this. And look, I don't buy the argument that all that matters is optics or perception is reality, and you know, I'm not into mob rule and so on, but sometimes the message you send is very clear and is very important. And in this case, that's one of them. And it should be said that a number of NASCAR survivors are on Michigan's gymnastics team, and they have said privately as well as a few publicly that they were very much in favor of Rhonda Fain being brought on board as a consultant, which is really a coach. That said, Rachel Den Hollander, who's become the unofficial spokesman in many ways for this group of victims, one of the most powerful people to testify up in East Lansing on this issue. She tweeted the following just 15 hours ago. When we learned that Coach Fain's illegal failure to report led to more abuse, she did not speak up, apologize, or help uphold USAG accountable. There are no excuses for this failure or her response when it became known. She was the vice president of the women's programs. She was in charge. This matters. I mean, there may be counter-arguments, but isn't that enough right there to think this might not be your best idea? And Rachel Den Hollander, you've had her on your show. She is not hard to reach. Maybe Michigan should have reached out to her first.
And it is worth noting that Rhonda Fain was hired after U of M's assistant gymnastics coach, Scott Vetteri, stepped down after a misdemeanor charge for obscene conduct in public. Police found him engaged in a sex act in a car with an 18-year-old gymnast. So between that and the university's response, once it began getting called out for the Fain hire by Regents and Nassar survivors, how would you rate all of that?
Well, to back it up a little bit, as far as the previous coach, look, if I was ever aware of that, I don't recall it. And yet, now when you have this situation, now a spotlight is put on that as well. You've had two basic failed attempts to hire a qualified assistant coach. That is not good, and it brought attention back to the previous situation. As far as Michigan's response since then, you've heard me say it a million times. I'm going to say it again, Cindy. Never turn a one-day story into a two-day story. Michigan had created for itself entirely an unforced error. It had created for itself a one-day story, and wisely the region stepped in and kept it a one-day story.
And Athletic Director Ward Manuel apologized for the hire. He said it was the wrong decision. Is that enough, John, or are there more questions the school needs to answer or actions that need to be taken here?
I think publicly that is enough. It's enough for me. Now, privately, how U of M works, I might have some questions internally that I'd want answered at the various levels of leadership, from the gymnastics program all the way to the presidency. And I suspect those are being answered right now.
What lessons should every single school take away from this?
This is serious business, and you don't play games with it. I don't know how much clearer we can make this. We keep on talking about after the Catholic Church scandal, Penn State happens. After Penn State happens, Michigan State happens, and we slap our foreheads wondering why this can continue to happen. I give Michigan credit, a lot of credit. Whatever her role was in the USA gymnastics program, she will not have a role at Michigan, and that strikes me as appropriate.
U of M sports commentator, John Eubank. And John, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We reached out to the University of Michigan for comment on the decision to hire Fain as a consultant, and they sent us a statement from Athletics Director Ward Manuel, and reads in part, and I quote, "It was the wrong decision, and I apologize. Our student athletes are our highest priority, and I want to do everything in my power to support them fully and put the focus back on their athletic performance." The stereotypical picture of someone with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, tends to be a young boy who just can't sit still in class. But that picture does not tell the whole story. There's increasing evidence that girls with this disorder are underdiagnosed. And while the symptoms might change over time, ADHD doesn't just disappear as you reach adulthood. So what does that mean for adult women with this disorder? Well, here to talk about that is Ann Arbor-based therapist Sari Solden. She counsels adults with ADHD. She's written books on women with the disorder. And with us now, Sari, welcome.
Nice to be here, Cynthia.
First, to get everybody on the same page, we hear of ADD, attention deficit disorder, and now ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. What are the differences? Because I'm wondering, as we talk today, are we kind of pretty well applying this to both?
Well, the name keeps changing, and the name used to be ADD. Now it's ADHD with three different types, so it's confusing. Sometimes we still use ADD because we're used to it, and we want to refer to people who don't have hyperactivity. But today we are going to focus more on what they call the inattentive type, because that's the most common one for women and the one that's most easily missed.
Yeah, let's start about that. Why are women less likely to be diagnosed with ADHD when they're young and more likely to be diagnosed later on in life?
Well, because they don't fit a stereotype of the hyperactive little boys that we still have. They don't cause problems often. They're actually often people pleasers, sometimes internalizing their problems, feeling anxious and depressed, but actually working hard. And teachers often like to have them in their classrooms, but they don't fit the stereotype. And often their symptoms are masked for a very long time, especially if they're smart, especially if they've had family support and have had structure. Often they're okay until they go to college or they're faced with managing their own lives, and then they hit a wall, either in college or after college when they have children or get married or start a job. At some point, the demands are too much for them.
Okay, so that image of the third grade little boy bouncing off the walls in the classroom, that's not what we're seeing, what we tend to see. And so, as you say, the girls are masking it. How are they able to mask it?
Well, they're not trying to mask it. That's just the way they're enculturated or the way they roll. They're just more often working hard, or they're smart, or their parents are helping them structure them. And so because ADD affects much more than academics, it's often not till they go away and try to lead a more independent life, have to manage their finances or their room or clean up themselves. So many more demands on their executive functioning, which is about what ADD is actually about.
Which leads me to have you break down for us, what is going on with ADHD?
You know, it's defined in so many different ways, but we like to think about it now more in terms of this complex brain wiring that affects the executive function or management functions of the brain. And this really is what women and men, but women often need to make their lives work. They're prioritizing, coordinating, organizing, activating themselves to figure out what to do, how to stay with it. And so it's complex syndrome of clusters of difficulties that is not the same in everyone, but it makes it difficult to lead an organized, routine life for an individual. And for women, that often collides with what they feel is their job description.
Okay. And do we know anything about what causes this?
Well, we don't have a firm hold on it now. We think that the dopamine and your neurotransmitters are involved, but they're doing so much more neuroimaging and research now to understand that it's in the complex networks of the brain.
Now, to get a sense of what it's like to live with it, let's hear your story. When were you diagnosed?
Well, I was diagnosed in my 40s, actually late. I was smart, just like a lot of girls. I was sweet, educated. School wasn't a problem because they told me what to do and they told me when it was due and I knew what to do. But life was more difficult. So I had no idea why I was in some areas doing great. In some areas, had no clue. I couldn't keep up with, didn't know how to get dressed, didn't know how to keep up with the teenage things, didn't know how to organize myself. They used to call me Messy Bessie, actually. No one knew who I was. But because I was educated and I was smart and I was doing okay, nobody really paid attention to it until I finally was working in an agency with adults with learning disabilities, a counseling agency that I was able to, at the right place at the right time, we started understanding that people with ADHD never had to have hyperactivity to have these very complex organizational problems. And so that's when the book started coming out, very early 90s, where we understood that you never had to have hyperactivity. And even for the adults that had hyperactivity, they often lost it then. And we thought it used to disappear. Now we understood in the early 90s.
And what was your feeling like when you kind of connected the dots and went, whoa?
Oh, me, like many women, feel very relieved. I read a book called You Mean I'm Not Lazy, Stupid, or Crazy in the early 90s. I went to my first ADD adult conference. I was living in California. I came to Ann Arbor for that. And it was the first time I saw hundreds of adults not hiding, not in the closet, not passing for normal, that I understood how much in daily life people, women and men, sort of hide their difficulties to try to fit in. And that's when I went back to California and started studying my clients.
I'm talking with Ann Arbor-based therapist Sari Solden, who counsels adults and particularly women who have attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD. What is the emotional toll that can happen? And let's talk about these women, these young women who, as you say, they go away to college or they're out on their own, and then the day-to-day, just they feel overwhelmed, they feel like they can't keep up. What emotional toll does that take?
And that's why, as a therapist, that's what I specialize in. You know, I say if at the end of the day you're only coping with ADD, that's a good thing, because the shame and the stigma and the hiding and withdrawal, trying to pretend that you're like other people, is what women do to compensate. They hide their difficulties, they feel ashamed, they have internalized this. They have brain shame, like instead of body shame that you compare yourself to. Women with ADHD don't realize it, but they're comparing, why can't I do what other women can do? They have no idea how to lead an organized routine life, even though there might be areas of their life that they do really well in. ADD is a very environmentally, situationally based disorder. So if you're in an environment that pulls on your strengths and has the right amount of structure or stimulation, you do great. If you're just there trying to figure out how to organize your house or manage a household or deal with all the
school day.
Yeah, yeah, school day, anything like that, you're out of control. You know, I work with people, not just women in their early 20s, but all the way up till 80, 85. Women are finally getting diagnosed more. And it's such an amazing relief just to know that it has a name and you're not crazy.
What is the diagnosis process?
Well, you know, there's no blood test. So you have to make sure you're going to somebody who really can do a nuanced interview. Not everybody needs to run out and get full thousands of dollar testing, although some people need that, especially in school, to understand your strengths and weaknesses. But you need to go to a professional. It could be any professional who's a specialist in adults and especially women. Good luck finding one with ADHD, because it's very subtle and it's severe and it's pervasive, but it's subtle. Women compensate. They sometimes self-medicate, lots of Diet Coke. They're trying to stimulate their brain, or they're getting a lot of help, or they're underachieving, or they're overworking. You can't judge from the outside. You have to understand how painful the difficulty is of having to manage your brain every minute of the day.
And what's the treatment?
Again, the treatment, call it the MEST model. You know, it's usually a combination of medication, which stimulants is often very helpful for a brain-based disorder. It's brain-based.
Right.
But that's not enough. You have to, the brain gives you the fuel to then start to see yourself from a whole perspective. So you can't just focus your life on your deficits. You can't wait until you're over this chronic condition. You have to get education, but you have to understand how your brain works well, and you have to get somebody, support, coach, therapist, somebody, a group to help you move toward finding a life that is meaningful to you, that where you can see your strengths and your difficulties, and you can not wait until you're like the woman next door. You know, like women want to become quote unquote normal. And we're trying to tell people only dogs and furniture need to be fixed. You could instead try to find a way to let yourself be yourself with the right kind of support.
Now, you mentioned medications, and Adderall is often mentioned for this. And so I'm wondering what kind of concerns you hear among patients with whether there's stigma or there's concern about abuse or addiction surrounding Adderall.
Well, I mean, I think that's in college. You know, other people with ADHD, other than college students, they just want to be normal. They just want to feel good. They do not want to feel high. They don't. So,
no.
But
and tell us, how does a stimulant like Adderall take the hyperactive attention deficit brain and reset it to?
I guess it's sort of a paradox, you know, because it doesn't. You would think it makes you more hyper,
yes. But
it's actually makes the transmission of information through your brain more consistent and more efficient. So you don't have to worry, is my brain going to work this day or this day? Mm-hmm. And it just makes it more, you can rely on your brain working. It's just a baseline, though. It's necessary often, but not sufficient. You need coaching. You need support. You might need an organizer. I have a whole team that I work with and try to figure out what it is that you need. You might need medication, organizing, coaching, therapy, because basically our therapeutic approach is what we call entangling, where that's the hardest, longest thing, but something that you can achieve where you can separate out your self-worth from your brain-based challenges. And for women, it's all one big blob until you do that work.
And I guess that's how I'm wondering, a woman, how does she learn to embrace that different way she thinks rather than trying to force herself to be, air quotes here,
right,
normal,
and
air
that,
quotes.
And that's the biggest challenge. And every woman, no woman has ever come in to see me in 30 years and says, I want to accept myself. They all say, I want to be fixed. I want to get over who I am. And so it's a long process of finding a therapist who can see you see your strengths, see you whole, help you understand there's two tracks. There's your chronic brain difficulties, and then there's you as a person, and you have to focus on that and not wait to get over your difficulties because it's chronic. You're going to get some improvement with medication and help and strategies, but that's not going to, you can't spend your whole life waiting to get quote unquote normal. Groups are really important. Online, there's so many resources now. There's a great national organization called ADDA, which is for adults with ADHD. The most therapeutic thing I've seen for women, besides, you know, finding a therapist or a coach who can understand you, is to find other women who also have not just the same difficulties, but also the same strengths and great personality, humor, resilience. There's a lot of great strengths.
Sari Solden, Ann Arbor-based therapist, author. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Today's Stateside was directed by Lindsay Scullin and engineered by Bob Scon. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Today's contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, and Bella Isaacs. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.